We'll check.
That I could adjust the record level.
Yeah.
Who am I talking to?
My name is Eric Hirschman. I'm a co-founder of Ushahidi and the iHub in Nairobi.
And what have you been doing here?
At Republica in Berlin. I've been here, I spoke on Monday, and then I've been part of the Global Innovation Lounge for all the other African tech hubs and labs coming to Republica.
All right, thank you. Now we begin. In your talk, you talked about the African startup scene. Can you give us a short glimpse into the scene? Or is there even a scene for the whole continent, or is it country-wise?
Yeah, it's actually, you know, we talk about Africa as a continent a lot, and sometimes it's a little bit misleading because, you know, you have 54 recognized countries and, you know, 9 territories and 2 new almost countries, right? Unrecognized countries. And so you end up having a balkanization of the continent in so many ways. But there has been some kind of meta trends happening across the continent at the same time. And that means things like mobile phone penetration, things like undersea cables and faster internet, you know, on the technology side, have trended across the continent. Therefore, we start seeing some of the similar patterns in different countries as well. So in the kind of the big countries with a lot of money or infrastructure, this is Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, Ghana, Senegal, Uganda, maybe Egypt, of course. These are the areas you see a lot of activities, and you see, I think, and maybe that's the best word to describe it. It's activity. It's still a nascent scene in that there's still a lot to do. It's not as active as other parts of the world. Not as far along in the number of companies coming out of there, but there is a lot happening now compared to where we were even 3 years ago.
What's the main difference to the European or US scene?
So I'd say the main difference is that it comes from where you interact with technology as a normal person, right? So in most places in Europe and the U.S., you come at it from a computer first. And so it doesn't matter who you are, you're much more used to a larger screen and that interaction. Whereas in Africa, you come at it from a smaller screen first. And therefore, you don't think of the internet in the same way. The internet to you might be your Facebook app on your phone, and you didn't know there was another internet at first. That's very common in some places, right? So, you know, there's people ask for the internet. They don't want the internet on their phone. They want Facebook on their phone. Okay, if that makes sense. So that's just a general user level, right? Which means that people who are developing applications and tools and services for the African market have to think of the mobile first. So it becomes really difficult for outsiders who've had a paradigm of big screen, computers first, to come in with a mobile first solution. And so you start seeing the competitive advantage that local entrepreneurs have over international ones and international, you know, big companies, multinational companies, because they understand the local mobile paradigm.
What you're also saying is that truly big companies, companies like Daimler or Microsoft, are not able to truly innovate. Why is that?
Well, I didn't say they aren't able to innovate. It's not in their best interest to innovate. Quite frankly, innovation is when you break down something in the status quo. It's that it's doing something differently. And simply put, organizations that are in a position of power have a vested interest in that not changing. Most of the time, okay? And so if they're looking for change, they say innovation is a buzzword now. They want innovation. Well, do they really want innovation? Because if they want innovation, it means it's going to break down something that they've done before. Sometimes it's a process. Sometimes it's a product. Sometimes it's a new business completely, right? We don't know what it is. But what happens is that the people who are, there's two problems. One is that they don't actually know what they're asking for. Number two is the people who are good at innovation, they push out of their organization a long time ago, and even out of their industry if possible, because those things that those people are doing seem so rebellious and seem so so threatening that they can't imagine them being a part of the ecosystem. And so they're on the fringes, right? And so these things that are really innovative actually are happening on those fringes. In a very local context, as in Berlin, as in Germany, and then as in Europe, as we see in the globe, and same within industries, right? And so there's this problem that if you want true innovation, that you're not really generally going to find it within a large organization. There's very few that have maintained that feel that they had when they were young companies or young industries and wanted to see change themselves. So and there's a really good case in point on this that's very new, yet is also now very much status quo. So that is the mobile phone operators, right? The mobile phone operators are really new. They're 15, 20 years old, right? And so imagine when they first came in, remember how disruptive they were? I can tell you how disruptive they were in Africa. They were massively disruptive. They messed up everything for a lot of people, right? Now they're the big guys. Now, if you want to change something that messes with them, they're like, no, we can't see that, right? And so that's what innovation is, though, and that's what happens to you. You tend to go through this evolution into becoming a larger company, so there's very few ones that are willing to take the chances on new crazy things that might break them down, but at least stop them from becoming irrelevant.
Innovation are the crazy things you make maybe from nothing or from the very little things at your disposal. The stories you tell, they revolve around that. But doesn't that become limiting sometimes because you have, what could you call it, a deficiency-driven innovation? So every time you have a problem, you start from scratch. Isn't that limiting?
Well, I don't think of innovation as starting from scratch yearly. I think that you start from somewhere and you iterate on what you have. Invention is starting from scratch in my book, right? So that's a little bit of splitting hairs over definitions, right? But I think what you have is you have different types of innovation that comes from when you have more and when you have less, okay? So if you're starting from nothing, you tend to, you know, be more open-minded and come up with something that might not look anything like what would have come before, but is maybe a little harder to penetrate other people's minds with as well at first. It depends on the product or the process that's being talked about, though. But then there's also this other thing, which is if you come from a place with very little, right? Like you have in a lot of places in Africa. Do you want me to stop while this guy goes by?
They will come back in a minute, probably.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. So then, if you're talking about like resource-constrained areas of the world, right, or societies or cultures, what happens is that you see a real practical innovation emerging. So the best kind of way for me to talk about this is you see the maker fairs that you have in Europe and the U.S., right? And they're a lot of fun. They're very fun and interesting. And a lot of hobbyists are there, just playing around with cool new stuff. And it's a blast. We do a maker fair in Africa as well. We've done one for the last 4 years in different countries, and it's overwhelmingly practical innovation based on tools that can be used and will change maybe a sector in a small way, or will earn an income for this individual who's making it. And that's the difference, is they're not doing it just for fun. They're not doing it for kicks and giggles. They're doing it for a real practical reason, and it's really practical in its use as well.
Do you see any problems here in the US that could be solved with that special kind of innovating?
Well, it's hard to say without a specific example, right? I think we could say broadly that the mindset needed to do. Okay, let me back up a little bit. I'll say this.
You were saying in your talk the quote was, where do I have it? Problems in US or Europe can be solved by solutions, products, and ideas coming from Africa. Which would that be?
So what I was talking about with the products and services and models and things like that coming from Africa are the things like M-Pesa, like Ushahidi, like Sproxel. These are technology, either products or models, that started in Africa and now are replicating around the world, right? And that's good. It's very simple technology generally. Nothing special about the technology itself. It's more about the usage of that technology and how it changes then, not just what happened in Africa, but it can be used elsewhere. And the interesting part about it is the fact that this technology could have been created in these other parts of the world 4, 5, sometimes 20 years earlier, but it wasn't. Why? The reason why is they didn't have a use case. They could not create it because they could not think of the problem to solve. right? But the problem was there in Africa or in Asia, you know, or in South America, and that created a new product out of old technology that is still useful. So M-Pesa is USSD. Ushahidi is mashup mapping. Sproxel is SMS-based counterfeit drug tracking. It's nothing new in any of these things, just a different way to put it together.
So now we have talked about innovation, about technology, about startups. Is there also in Africa a kind of political agenda that the Net community has?
No, it's not. I kind of wish there was, but there's not, because it's not unified enough. We can go back full circle to where we started this conversation with, which is the that kind of balkanization of the African continent by country means that it doesn't have a unified front when it comes to any type of political agenda. So when you have, you know, big ICANN meetings or you know, like the big UN internet meeting last year in, was it Doha or Dubai or something? You know, there's countries that present themselves, but it's not a unified bloc, which means that it's easy to kind of separate and conquer if you have, you know, ulterior motives for the internet in Africa right now.
But also the other way around, is there any political things that happen through the internet, social media or anything like that? Like not net-related political agendas.
Right. Yeah, actually, there's a lot, right? I mean, I think North Africa leads in everybody's minds in how they've used the internet and technology to kind of make political statements as a society and see change happen. I mean, Ushahidi came from Kenya, which was very much around the post-election violence of the election there in 2008. And so, you know, we're seeing Africans using technology, simple technology. Again, it's usually SMS, it's Facebook, it's Twitter, to make their voices heard. And sometimes with enough mass and enough movement on the ground, those things actually make a difference.
One last question. You were also saying that you don't believe in aid for Africa, which is of course a very cliche picture we have maybe here in Europe and in the US. Why do you don't believe in aid?
And maybe my position on aid is colored from, you know, growing up and living my whole life in Africa and seeing that more positive change has come about because of large mobile operators coming into existence. You know, the cell phone has made more change in Africa happen than 50 years of billions of or trillions of dollars worth of aid. So I just am more, you know, and let me, I'll slice it a little bit, and I'll say that sometimes there's a need for emergency relief aid. That's a different type of thing than the general bilateral aid. But the bilateral aid does a couple things, which is it undermines the authority of the government, and it takes away their responsibility to their people to do their job. And that's one of the biggest problems I have with it. Never mind the fact that there's very few things that have ever come out of it really positively over time. But the fact is, it's very, at a very principal level, it undermines the authority of the people who are supposed to be in authority, and it takes away their responsibility to the people they're supposed to be responsible to. And so on a very fundamental level, I push back on the need for that as much as I do the agenda that comes with that money.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.